I think there is different ways to propel a narrative action. And you have to make a decision pretty early on when you start on the type of story it's going to be. If it's truly a story about a community, you want the reader to go on a journey with you. You know, like if this is a dispatch, you want them to feel like they too are driving into this place. So the idea was getting a sense that, all right, we're here. Everything would look the same as if you just saw it, and then you step inside, and then you realize things are a mess.
Welcome to the Nonfiction Podcast. I'm Matt Pusateri. Welcome to episode 21. Today, I talk with Robert Samuels about his story for the Washington Post. His American dream died. His town got over it. The story ran last March. Robert is a national politics reporter for the Washington Post. His official bio says that he focuses on the intersection of politics, policy, and people. It also says that he travels the country to chronicle how the vivacious political discussion in the nation's capital is impacting the lives of everyday Americans. Before going to the Washington Post, Robert spent 5 years at the Miami Herald. He's a graduate of the Medill School of Journalism and the former editor-in-chief of the school newspaper, the Daily Northwestern. So I know I almost always love the stories that I have on the podcast, but I will say that this is one of the more haunting pieces I read all year. I touch on that in our interview, but this is one of those stories that once I read it, it really stuck around in my head for a while. And even though in some ways it's kind of a quiet story, what it says about America is troubling. So here's a brief excerpt from the story. The goofy red sign off State Road 23 still says Eddie's Steak Shed, just as it always has. The thank you plaques for sponsoring the County Little League are still in the front entrance, alongside 15 years worth of stickers honoring the steaks as the area's best. But farther inside, most everything has changed in the years since the old owner was detained, then deported, as part of a crackdown on undocumented immigrants by a tough-talking new president. Robert Beristain, a former dishwasher who worked until he could afford to buy the place, was gone. In his place were refurbished wood-paneled walls, a bar with a granite counter, and a new pork chop entree. Even the name had been changed with something snappier, sleeker. Eddie's was now simply The Shed. Okay, so here's my standard disclaimer that you've probably heard a million times. If you haven't already read the story, the link to the article is in the show notes and on the podcast website at nonfictionpodcast.com. Go ahead and pause the show. Come back after you've read it. Okay, got it? Let's go. Here is my interview with Robert Samuels. Robert, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's wonderful being here.
Thanks. This is one of these stories that I read and it just kind of haunted me for like a week or two. And it still bothers me. I just read it again before talking to you. And it's one of these nonfiction stories that just kind of gets under my skin. And so I'm really curious about a lot of things about this story. For those of people that haven't read it yet, can you give like a short summary of what this story is about?
Sure. This story is about how a community reacted to the deportation of a popular restaurant owner. The community is Granger, Indiana. It's a suburb outside of South Bend. And they had a restaurant owner named Roberto Beristain, who was recently purchased a popular steak joint known as Eddie's Steak Shed. What people didn't know was Roberto was an undocumented Mexican immigrant. And in the early days of the Trump administration, Roberto was deported under a series of very strange circumstances. He had no criminal record. He wasn't arrested for anything. No one called ICE on him. But he was deported And Granger, which is a conservative town, immediately reacted in confusion and furor because they loved Roberto. And so my editor and I decided that we should go back after a year and get a sense of whether or not the community was still upset and what that says about where we are as a country and how people are processing this immigration issue.
That's a great summary. And so this is a spoiler alert for people that haven't read it. They kind of got over it. They were not outraged a year later. What was your expectation? Well, first of all, what was the assignment? You kind of just described it. Did you go there with a particular sense of where things were going? You know, what did you expect to find when you headed out to Granger to do the story?
Well, we weren't completely sure what we were going to find. The assignment was simply at the Post, my job is to humanize and find ways to enter the political conversation with matching it with storytelling and human emotion. And we were really interested in the idea of following up with these big deportation stories that happened at the beginning of the Trump administration. There are a handful of them. All of them went viral in various cases. There are big ideas on Reddit about this is going to be one of the first instances of Trump voter regret, that people who voted for him do not realize that when these immigration policies are enacted, people they love will get ensnared in them. So we went out to do a test to see if this was true. Indiana itself struck me as being interesting. Mostly it's the state of Mike Pence, but also because these people had a very large response to this. They're on Anderson Cooper. But also Roberto's wife had voted for Donald Trump. And so there was a natural tension inside the story that we thought was interesting to enter into. Going in there, I'm not completely sure if I had a strong idea of how the people were going to react. We had spoken with Roberto's wife. We had had some conversations with his lawyers and some abbreviated conversations with his friends, all of whom really missed him. But I spent a lot of time in that part of the middle of the country. And I also know that news is fast and furious, and there was a strong chance that people would have taken that moment at that time and sort of forgot about it or moved on with their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what's so haunting about this piece to me is that I remember after the election happened, I was talking to someone that I'm close with who voted for Trump. And he was adamant that, like, you know, he supported Trump because he thought, like, you know, he agreed with a lot of the taxes or whatever. But and he said, well, you know, he's not really going to deport people. He's only going to deport the criminals. And then I felt like when stories like this came out, you know, not your story, but the original story, that this guy who had been pretty much a law-abiding restaurant owner had been deported, someone with a family, someone with long roots in the community, that there would be a lot of outrage, that there would be some sense of like, wow, this is way over the line. And I think what's so troubling is how quickly, like you said, this passes over. When you see that there was outrage, but it didn't last very long, and sort of life just went on.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of that speaks to the human condition, but it also speaks to the times in which we live. The president promised on the campaign that when he got into office, things would happen so quickly your head would spin. And, you know, I sit next to a bunch of news reporters and their heads are certainly spinning at the pace in which we have to keep up with just the news of the day. And to experience that within a community setting is also really difficult. And I think, you know, there's a cynical way of looking at what happened in Granger, Indiana, to think that maybe these people were not as outraged about the idea of undocumented people who are good people getting deported. And there's another way of looking at it that's sort of explained in the story, that there's a lot going on. And we were there a little bit after the Parkland shooting. There was opioid drop-off nearby. And there's a lot to contend with in terms of keeping the mental space to allow yourself to be outraged.
Right. So let's walk through, like, when you actually got to Granger and started reporting this. Like, how did you start to decide who to talk to, and how did you start to dive into the actual reporting of this?
So before I got there, I had a bunch of conversations with people who knew Roberto. And some of them lived in Granger, and his family was in Mexico, and we talked a little bit. So I got a nature of who he was and what the issue was. By the time I got to Granger, I had already made contact with Angela Banfi, who's in the story. She's a waitress who had known the family for years. And the idea was to go to spend some time with her and sort of get a sense of looking at Granger through her eyes. What helped as a storytelling device was that there was a very defined place of action in which you could talk about this. He owned a restaurant. And typically, there's nothing... It seems to be a little cliche to go to a restaurant and talk to people about things, but in this sense, it made lots of sense because it was the fulcrum of the story. Mm-hmm. And you can find people who had known him, who had not known him. The restaurant had changed hands and had a different sort of look. We didn't talk to the restaurant owner before we got there. So that was a bit of a crapshoot. So the first day I went, I think I had the lamb chops because it was special that day.
Yeah.
And I sat at the bar and I spoke with people. And then I talked to a waitress and let her know what I was doing. And she told other waitresses and other waiters, some of whom felt really comfortable and passionate about this issue, some who did not. And then they went and got the owner. I told him that I just wanted to spend some time in his restaurant and get a sense of it. And the owner was very laissez-faire. he understood what I was interested in doing. But I think he also wanted to show that this was not the story of his restaurant. This was the story of a bygone time.
Right.
And I think that was really helpful in sort of being able to craft it.
You mentioned in the story that there were, you know, certain employees that were unwilling to share their names.
Yeah.
Were there stories and things that they told you you felt like you couldn't use because people were just uncomfortable being involved?
Well, no. I think a number of the details that we had about Roberto and the restaurant were confirmed by a number of people, both who worked in the restaurant and who knew him. So we felt comfortable using those details.
Mm-hmm.
I think with a piece like this, the reason that they didn't want their names to be used was more compelling than the actual last name. When Helen, Roberto's wife, came out and spoke to all these news organizations and mentioned that she voted for Trump, she got a lot of animosity, both right. from liberals and conservatives. And, you know, that's very scary in a small town, particularly in a polarizing time. And I had the sense that allowing the reader to understand that that was the fear was more important than making sure our last name was in there.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of stories and people said things that people told me, I felt comfortable using it. Well, mostly because they're confirmed by many people, and this is a story of mood and emotion, and those things were still allowed. Those things were still available, even if the last thing was not.
Right. So I wanted to ask you about, there's definitely an element of racism, or at least implied racism, in a lot of the reactions you get from people, right? And,
yeah.
And not always in the way you would expect, right? Like that I would expect, I would say. Like, you get some people saying things that definitely strike me as racist, even if they don't mean it in a bad way. So for example, Angela Banfi, who was a friend and a waitress there, she says, "I didn't even see Robert as Mexican. He was not one of those Mexicans. He was like a white boy to me." And I was curious about how you handled the decision to include that in the story, or when you have people say something like that, which on one part I know probably makes this story much more telling, but I don't know, do you worry about how the kind of light that sheds on her or what that says when you have a quote like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good question. And I think it's a question that people who, like a lot of us who try to be empathetic, sympathetic, and generally good people struggle with, right?
Right.
And there are a few things. One is your obligation to tell the truth in as full a way as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a sense that you don't want to censor a feeling or a mood or an idea because you know people might find that idea unnerving or upsetting. I wouldn't want it. That's not sort of the conversation that I'd want to people. Oh, that I'd want people to make for me. That's not a decision that I would want if someone were writing my story to make for me. The other thing is, I think, especially now, in the advent of commenting and what can happen on social media, it's very important for me to be clear with what I'm doing and who I am. So when you remind someone that you're a reporter, you know, like I'm a little bit older than the average reporter now. And so I still use a notepad, and that's very transparent that I'm writing things down. And when things like that happen, that's usually a time for me to pause or to come back at a later moment and say, yeah, you know, like when you said this, I just want to make sure that I understood what you were saying. In the case of what Angela said, the first time she used that sort of line of thinking, we were on a phone call together. I was still in Washington and doing some prep work before I went out to Indiana. And we went out to lunch, and we were talking, and then she said it again. And she looked at me and said, oh, well, you can't put that in the newspaper, can you? No, you can't. You can't put that in the newspaper. And I said to her, well, I can if you're comfortable with me doing it. And she paused and she said, put it in.
Huh.
So that was her decision. And I think it was the right decision on her part. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the right decision to show because race, you know, I know this sort of intuitively as a Black man in America, but like race is a pervasive and insidious thing. And it comes out, and the ideas of what it is and what's normal and what's not normal comes out in subtle ways that really impact one's way about thinking about the world and perceiving the world. And just as a journalistically soapbox, I think it's wrong and a disservice to sort of edit those things out.
Mm-hmm.
If the story is not explicitly talking about race and racism, mm-hmm. Because it's such a ever-present idea in our society.
Right. You get a similar quote from the other person that was a regular and a friend to the guy that was deported. His last name was Matheny.
Yeah.
When he kind of has this line, he says, we need to do something to help end prejudice. If there are so many illegal people in the country, then it gives license to believe every immigrant is illegal. He has a couple of quotes in there that are on the edge like that, where it seems on one hand, he liked Roberto, but on the other hand, he's holding these beliefs about immigrants that he's just kind of putting out there.
Yeah. Well, this is a complex situation for lots of people.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, what struck me about the logic was it seems so counterintuitive to people I know who live in Washington, D.C. Here's a man saying, I like immigrants. I like what they do to the community. And it's because there are so many illegal immigrants that it's making it bad for all of them. And, you know, that's typically not the rhetoric we hear coming from people. But at the same time, it was a very real and genuine way of perceiving the issue. And it was also not an uncommon belief.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, this is part of the reason I do the job that I do, but mm-hmm. there are nuances and gradations of how people perceive this issue,
mm-hmm.
especially when it comes to their friends and especially when it comes to issues of identity.
Right.
And I think that sort of helps enrich what's going on. My hope would be that folks in Indiana would read this and say, like, yeah, this seems right. There's nothing surprising about it. Mm-hmm. And I'd also hope that people who don't have that mindset or looking into this as a way of peering into a slice of America they don't know would sort of stand up and say, oh, they're thinking about this in an entirely different way. And I might have to recalibrate my thinking to understand what they're saying.
Right. And I think what's so disturbing about this piece in some ways, first of all, it almost reads like a parable. It almost strikes me like this, you know, if you had written a short story about an imaginary town reacting to the era of Trump, it would be something like this, right? Where you have this metaphor for immigrants and people getting deported and how people move on. But the guy that you were talking to, he has a realization, right? And you get these great quotes from him, and it's a credit to you and your reporting. He says, and he's talking about how after they found out that he'd been deported, he says, it changed my view on how the country treats its immigrants, he said. I thought they would go after, like Trump said, those who were bringing in drugs and the rapists. But they went after a regular guy who just cared about living the American dream. And so at this point, I'm reading this and I'm thinking, this is great. This is a Trump voter who has had an epiphany. He's had a realization about what's actually happening there. But the end of the story, he's kind of like saying, like, well, but the economy is going well and my taxes are down. So, you know, I guess I'm going to be optimistic. And it's kind of the, he has this, you know, epiphany on like page, you know, two thirds into the story. And then by the end, when you're talking to him, he's kind of clearly moved on. And he can represent millions of people in this country.
Yeah. And I want to be clear that I think that's a very real and genuine emotion. Mm-hmm. And I can think of so many things in my life where it's just really simple to move on. You know, mm-hmm. I live in Washington, D.C., and how I sort of treat a panhandler when I see them can be acting for a second, and then I just sort of move on in my life. You know, it's sort of that's sort of the wonder and bewildering thing about like the Childish Gambino "This Is America" video, right? These things are going on, and yet there's still people finding joy and dancing. And I think that's it. And I'm really thankful, and I'm glad that you sort of read it as a parable, because in my sense it is. Mm-hmm. And that's the idea of doing this story. But also it's a way to kind of remind ourselves that politics isn't easy. Dealing with people isn't easy on its own in the absolute values of themselves. And then when they sort of like abut each other, it becomes really difficult for folks to process. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when things are hard to process, you just go to bed or move on to the next challenge.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I'm actually talking to a New York Times writer that did a story about a homeless woman, and he profiles her whole life, who passed away. And, you know, like, I lived in Washington, D.C. for years, and I probably passed the same homeless people for years coming off the metro. And I think even now, even though I know some of these things and I realize the state's, it's so easy to just tune it out.
Yeah.
Nobody's completely mindful all the time of issues, even if they're aware of them, I guess. So let me, getting back to the reporting of this thing, you're talking to all these people. How did you know you had enough stuff? How did you know you had what you needed? This is the question I literally ask every single person that's been on this show. I'm always baffled with when people know, all right, that's it. I've got all the elements I need. I've got all the pieces I need to write this story. When do you know that that's what you're at?
You know when you feel all your questions have been answered, and also when things stop surprising you in the context of this story. You know, this is not the prototypical narrative in which you follow a single person. It's the profile of a place. And so the idea is being able to evoke the mood and feeling of a place. And you know it when people are talking to you and your eyes are starting to be like, yeah, I get it. I get it. And so that's what happened. But I mean, it took probably 60 to 70 interviews to get there. So yeah, but that's, I'm probably one of the worst reporters in the newsroom at knowing when it's enough.
Right. So as you start to work on the actual writing of the piece, how do you sort through all that? And like you said, you did 60, 70 interviews. How do you pick out the pieces that actually make it into the story?
So I do a lot of thinking, and I'll have a discussion with my editor a little bit about what I've heard. You know, I'm blessed with a editor who's very good at distilling information. So we'll have a phone call and I'd say, all this stuff happened. And I'll just sort of go through it. And he'll say, oh, I guess it's a story about people moving on. And I'll say, oh, yeah, that's right. So that's really helpful. But then I sort of think about the moments that were variations of the theme that really stuck out to me as a person trying to understand this issue, reverting back to the actual theme or the mission of the story. From then, I go through my notes and I start typing out quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll have a separate set of post-it notes where I'll put various scenes on the post-it notes, and I'll literally place them on a table like a jigsaw puzzle and move them until it gets to an arrangement that I feel it sort of like honors the natural arc of the story and tells it in a compelling way.
Right. I'm always interested in the stuff that does make the cut. So
yeah.
The end of the piece, you have this conversation between this couple called the Peppers.
Yeah.
Right. To include a pretty decent length of the actual exchange, they're having their own debate about immigration and what do you do about it and what do you do about these things. To me, it almost read like comedy because they can't figure out how to understand it or think about it. And then they just say, yeah, this, it's too sad. Now I'm depressed. You know?
Yeah.
And they kind of move on. Like,
yeah.
You know, how did you decide? Because that's a pretty good chunk of the story towards the end. You know, what jumped out to you that had to fit in there since you only have so many words to include?
Well, it's for me, it's better to have people do the work with each other. You know, the less that I can do to influence what's happening between people, the better it is, sort of the more organic the way people are speaking. And the Peppers are super interesting because I thought they too were kind of emblematic of what was going on in this place to try to suss everything out. And at one point, you know, I said to them, you know, I'm really sorry. I can just leave because, you know, you guys came out to have a good dinner. And Heather said, no, this is a very intellectual conversation. We want to have it with you. We want to go through this. And I said to them, I was like, what should we do about Roberto and immigrants? And then they started this idea about the boat and who gets to be on the boat. And it became very confusing for them. And a man next to them he essentially tells them to shut up and says, like, this is really hard. But like now that you're talking about it, I see it in the comedic sense. But experiencing it, it honestly didn't feel that way to me. It felt like this is how we're going to process this. You know, we had a man that could affect the way we view the world. And that's really hard. So let's distill it. Let's displace it a little bit more. Let's create an analogy and like let's work for it that way. You know, it's sort of the same idea that we saw in the campaign with the like couple of Skittles. There was a thing,
right?
You know, it's like
right.
Five of them were poisoned, and then the Donald Trump metaphor, the reading of the Donald Trump poem about the snake, which became a very popular trope in the campaign, and it just sort of served as a reminder to me that people who don't have blue checks on Twitter do the exact same thing when they're trying to put it in. So that's why I included so much of it.
Yeah.
And I, you know, generally my reporting style is I really enjoy dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up reading comic books, mm-hmm. and so it's sort of like the way I sort of think about things, but also a lot of the narrative writers who I admired, they're so great at picking up Arya's sense of language and sort of in the phraseology of how people put words together. Sometimes it told a lot more than kind of me rewriting it in a more journalistic-y sense. So that's why I prefer to let things breathe.
So wait, so let me back you up a bit. So how does your comic book sort of, you know, enjoyment as a kid, how does that affect how you work as a reporter?
So I think both in terms of dialogue and in perspective. If you speak with my mother, she'd say she loved us reading comic books because it taught us how to have a good conversation. Because you have sort of these characters who are going and sort of talking to one another and then having these separate frames of them sort of going into themselves and mm-hmm. explaining to themselves what they're thinking, the difference between the dialogue bubble and the thought bubble.
Right.
And understanding that as a tool for storytelling, mm-hmm. I find as a reporter is super helpful because in this, you know, there are lots of great reporters here who have a little bit more time to put stories together than I do. And they're able to sort of be able to witness and experience things within action that can allow a person to unfold over the time of the story. I tend not to have that luxury. And so being able to oscillate between, all right, like, do your thing. Also, let me come back to you and say, like, what are you thinking? You know, that's sort of the frame, that's sort of the, like, comic book frame that sort of will be able to propel the story in a way.
That's so interesting. I was actually at a conference many, many years ago, and Tom French, who's a well-known writer and editor, I think he's won numerous awards, somebody asked him at the end of a session, do you have any recommendations on books to do better storytelling or do better narrative? And he says, absolutely, I have my number one book for that. And everyone was like getting out their notepad to write it down. And he says, it's the DC Comics Guide to Writing Comics.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I was like, what? And his whole thing was that the book goes through this all so much about how you set up narrative and scenes and framing motivations. And that he said that he always goes back to that. And he sees that as really instructive for thinking about how to tell stories.
Yeah.
So you're in good company with that.
Yeah, I didn't know. I know Tom, but I did not know that about him. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, I have that somewhere on my shelf at home and still need to get through it.
Yeah.
I also wanted to ask...
I'm going to go buy it.
I also wanted to ask you... You were talking about, you know, being at the table with these people. How do you establish a rapport with people so that they feel comfortable talking to you about this stuff or talking, you know, with you sitting there? They know you're a reporter from Washington, D.C., right?
Yeah.
You've got the notepad out or the recorder. How do you get them to feel at ease that they could be having like a normal conversation or speak to you candidly in the way that obviously a number of these people did?
You know, I get that question a lot. The answer is I don't know. I go out and I try to present myself as honestly and as earnestly as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's sort of a mix of my active curiosity. Like, I'm a very active listener. I allow people to continue talking. I try not to interrupt them. When they stop, I wait for 4 or 5 seconds just to see if they're going to say anything more. And so I think people feel comfortable talking to me because I'm not actually doing that much talking. And I think now, particularly, there is an active interest in having someone say, all right, you're here. You say you want to tell the real story. So I want you to go back to Washington and tell the real story. I want you to get it right. And I try to join them. I had tried to have them join with me on this mission. You know, I sort of explain why I'm here. I've come from Washington, D.C. because I really want to know about this. I need your help in understanding what's happening so I can go back and tell things in the correct way. And I think people really join with me in that message. And that's a part of it. My boss would say it's because I'm just a good listener.
Right.
But I think it's typically because I'm a good listener because I actually want to know. I have like a legitimate fascination with the people who I'm talking with, and that goes a long way.
So let's get back to where we left off. You have all these note post-its on your table as you're kind of clustering parts of the story. What's your writing process like once you kind of get the basic, you know, pieces of the story in place? Do you then just go from start to finish, or do you do it in little scenes? How do you pull it, you know, put it actually on the page?
Yeah. So by the time I've sort of finished with the post-it notes, I have a sense of how the story goes. In the best world, it's speaking to me already. So like I'm hearing my inner voice tell me what to write, tell my fingers what to do. Which is always a dangerous prospect because, you know, then your fingers do it and you're like, oh, man,
right.
My inner voice sounded so much more brilliant than my actual But I tend to go through it like that, and I try to do as much as I can. I'm a fairly jumpy guy, so I often have to take it scene by scene and say, all right, get to the section, take a break, come back, and keep going from there.
And how do you decide like where the story starts and where it ends? In this piece, you kind of start with a description of kind of coming off the state road and heading towards the restaurant. How do you decide that this is the way to lead into this piece?
I think there is different ways to propel a narrative action. And you have to make a decision pretty early on when you start on the type of story it's going to be. If it's truly a story about a community, you want the reader to go on a journey with you. You know, like if this is a dispatch, you want them to feel like they too are driving into this place. So the idea was getting a sense that, all right, we're here. Everything would look the same as if you just saw it. And then you step inside and then you realize things are a mess. That something's missing, and what's missing? Roberto's missing.
Right.
And the idea is to distill from that big idea and then continue going until something hits you that resonates, that gets to the end of it. Tom French actually would say, this is one of his tips that I learned from him, you start strong and you build to better. I think, actually, with this story, I had a disagreement, not a disagreement. My editor and I saw the ending differently. I thought at first it was better to end with that scene with the peppers because it sort of like it had that anecdote about the boat and it sort of had that hearkening to the discussion of what immigration was and why you needed to curb illegal immigration or ban Muslims or things like that. And Stephen, my editor, he was like, well, I'm just really struck by this guy saying he prefers to be optimistic. And I can't stop thinking about it.
Right.
And Stephen is a great mind, and he sort of has that distance from the story. And I said to him, well, I think it sounds a little moralistic, but I trust your instincts more than mine. And if you think that's the right idea, then I trust you. And so we did it, and it was the right idea in retrospect. Because that final scene really resonated with a lot of readers.
Right. It's really kind of a gut punch.
Yeah. And,
because the very last line is him saying, no one wants to admit the economy is better, but it's better. My taxes are down. Roberto is gone, but there's reason to be optimistic. I prefer to be optimistic. And I mean, it's just a capsulization of this weird split perspective people have on this, you know? And it's also like such a callous, I mean, he probably doesn't intend it this way. I don't want to paint this guy as a villain or something, but it's such a callous way of looking at this guy's life has been destroyed basically, or at least turned upside down, but you're getting 2% tax cut. And so that kind of makes it okay. And so ending with that, I think, is really just this kind of punch because it's like, oh my God. Because again, I'm sure he's speaking for a lot of people.
And I think Stephen was right. And I think in my sense, it was like, yeah, but that's how it goes. I mean, I think also, remember, we're in a part of a country that really sort of believes in the power of self and individualism, and lives can be destroyed, but it's not my life. And I think you're seeing those sort of ideas playing out. And Srivathsani definitely did not mean it in a mean-spirited way. He meant it in a really positive way that, yeah, I miss my friend, but should I dwell on the fact that I miss him all the time? Should that be the way that I view the way this country's headed? That simply because I miss my friend? No, actually, I prefer to be optimistic because there are things to be optimistic about. And I think it definitely evinces a way of thinking about things, you know? And was that not what these past elections have been about, or our current politics have been about? The idea of who's winning, what part of the country is winning, and at the expense of another part of the country or another group of people. And I think that's really just kind of where we are.
So this story comes
Real
about.
good story. Sorry.
it's incredibly haunting, but at the same time, it's not like it's. There's moments in it that feel very real and very human. I mean, you're not painting anybody as a villain here or some kind of mustache twirling character. I think that makes it even that much more devastating because these all seem, for the most part, like decent people, but you know, decent people seem a little too willing to see things like this happening and be mad about it for a week. So the story came out in March. What kind of reaction did you get to the piece?
I was really stunned by the reaction, actually, because it was fairly impactful. The numbers, sort of like the technical readership numbers, looked good. People stayed with it for a long time. And people were struck by how tragic and haunting the tale was, because I think people really did believe that once you saw the sort of deportation strategy being pushed by the Trump administration carried out, that it would change everything. And so I think for some folks, it heightened their sense of despair. I don't mean that in a glib way, but it sort of elucidated the idea that maybe it's not that easy. Maybe there's something a little bit more complex in the country that I don't fully understand, because this happened to this man and this is how the town's responding. And it really struck me. It really did. One thing I do have to say is that, dependent on the stories that I do, you know, the people who respond and send you emails, they'll vary. And my worry for when I came back and I brought this story and I said to Stephen, this is what it is. These people aren't that upset. They've moved on. They've lost that feeling that Iphigenia, one of the characters, talks about in the story. And to me, that made sense just because of the ways I'd worked on this huge series in which you talked to untold numbers of voters at the end of the Iowa caucus. And sort of this thinking to me made sense. It was a very familiar way of thinking to me. And Steven said, like, no, I actually think it's a pretty great story. And so, you know, it's one of those things you write, you give it your best, you do it as honestly and as fully as possible. And you're saying, I don't know how this is going to go. But I think it was sort of a reminder to me of the type of work that we need to continue doing. So, like, sort of like these ideas don't feel as familiar.
Right.
Don't feel as unfamiliar, rather.
Yeah. I was also struck, there was a quote in the middle of the piece by, or towards the end of the piece actually, by, I think this is the mother-in-law. And
yeah.
She says, we have to think about it, her mother replied, because it's not just our family. It's going to be millions of families who are affected by it. If we don't think about it, nothing will change. And I almost felt like that was the counterpoint to what the story ends with the guy, you know,
yeah,
the other guy's quote. And first of all, I have to imagine as a reporter, your jaw must drop when you get a quote like that. They're just putting to words such a powerful expression of what this story is all about.
Yeah. Well, my jaw doesn't drop because I think I have a really big mouth. It would be very distracting for folks. But also, I try to spend a lot of time with people, and what's on the page is a mere fraction of the conversations that we have. But you know, when I'm doing those interviews, I'm trying to get them to a place, or, you know, like I think I interviewed the mother-in-law with the sister-in-law. I'm sorry, I don't have my notes with me at the time, right now. But, you know, I'm trying to get them to a place where they're really thinking about this in a deep way and trying to tap into the reason they talked with me. They agreed to talk with me because they wanted folks to remember that they had this brother-in-law, the son-in-law, who was a good man, and a terrible thing happened. And so the quest is to really be able to get them to articulate it in ways that make sense and can hit people. And I'm so surprised, mostly when, as reporters, we don't give people that opportunity, you know, that you're dealing with someone for whom the stakes are very high. They're going to be made even higher by their presence in a newspaper. And you don't sort of give them the time to really methodically think about what it is they're saying and the message they want to convey to the world. And in this case, we're there, we're talking about it, we're probably an hour in, and her daughter says, you know, I just can't handle it. And that's when the mom says, no, we have to. Like, we have to do this. And I think those moments, they're not matters of journalistic happenstance. They're moments that come from actually kind of respecting the person you're dealing with.
Well, like I said at the outset, this is one of the best pieces I've read this year. You did an amazing story with this piece, so congratulations.
Thank you,
on that. And thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been really, really interesting, and I love getting to hear about how you put this amazing story together.
Yeah, thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thanks again so much to Robert Samuels for coming on the podcast this week. One thing that occurred to me after I finished up my interview with Robert was that this was actually the third episode in a row for the Nonfiction Podcast that dealt with issues of immigration. That wasn't by design or by any master plan on my part. Literally, it was just sort of three great stories in a row that happened to touch on this topic. And I think that's why this story is that much more devastating, because it shows that this is a real issue for real people, and it has tremendous impacts on people's lives. I think last week when we talked with Netta Samani about her story, about her family coming over from Iran, it showed just how much people were willing to do to get here and to escape a dangerous situation in another country. And in this story, we showed the really dark side of some of Donald Trump's policies that means that productive members of American communities can get deported. And what haunts me still about this story is just how quickly this town just sort of moved on. how quickly they shook their heads and felt bad for a day or two, and then things went back to normal. And that kind of normalization of things like this happening to people, people that live near you and with you, I don't know, it's scary. And I'm glad people like Robert Samuels are telling these stories and making sure that we don't forget about people like Robert Beristain. Okay, that's it for this week. If you enjoyed this show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. That really does help people discover the show and learn more about it. And hey, if you made it all the way to the end, thank you, as always, for listening to the Nonfiction Podcast.